Welcome to Wealthability, where we're always discovering how to make way more money while paying way less taxes. Hi, this is Tom Wheelwright, your host, founder, and CEO of Wealthability. What if you could make outstanding investment decisions every single time in 3 minutes or less? Today, you're going to learn how to develop specific investment criteria that will boost your likelihood of always making successful investment decisions. And the key, as we've talked about before, is the difference between acting as an amateur investor on your investments and a professional investor. So an amateur over here on the liability side and a professional over here on the asset side. We've already discussed before that one of the differences is that a professional is always going to specialize, where an amateur tends to diversify. Related to this is getting even more specific, where an amateur will be scattered. Absolutely scattered. In other words, well, whereas a professional will be focused, so an amateur will always make new decisions. In fact, every single investment for an amateur is a new decision. Should I buy this or not? It doesn't matter if it's real estate. Oh, should I get into real estate? Oh, should I buy single family? Oh, this stock looks really good to me. Maybe I should buy that. Wow, this guy's business. It seems like I should be invested in that. Professional investor makes one decision and applies that decision over and over and over again. I want you to think about some of the wealthiest people in the world. These are great investors. Warren Buffett. Some people think, well, he's all about multiple companies and diversification. But he's not. He actually invests in very few companies. He has control over the company, and he invests the same way every single time. He's made a single decision on his investment criteria for a company. First of all, he only invests in companies, right? You don't see Warren Buffett out investing in real estate. You don't see him out investing in oil and gas, do you? You see him investing one thing. Okay, let's take kind of the flip side of Warren Buffett, all right? Let's take our friend, I call him our friend because I absolutely love this guy, Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, solar. What are we talking about here? Well, what does he do? He invests in technology. He's a specialist in technological innovations, and in particular in energy and use of energy. If you look at when he launches a rocket in SpaceX, he's looking at the technology to bring it down, of course, but he's looking at the energy to send it up. If you look at Tesla, it's the energy in the batteries and the storage in the batteries. If you look at solar, that's energy. So he's really looking at technological improvements in energy. So if you look at Elon Musk, there's an example of, is he a professional? I don't think anybody questions he's a professional. A little crazy sometimes, but he's a professional. Does he specialize? Absolutely. Is he focused? Sometimes he seems distracted. But the reality is, if you look at what he's doing, he's very focused and he's made a single decision. This is what I'm going to do. This is what is important to me. You look at Bill Gates. Bill Gates, what does he do? Software. That's it. And it's consumer software, right? This is software that anybody can use. You don't see a lot of Microsoft applications for big companies. Now, I'm not saying they're not there. I'm just saying that where Microsoft makes its money and where Microsoft has put its energy and its money is into consumer software. That's a very specific investment business strategy, okay? And business is an investment, right? So that's a very specific strategy. Where take Apple. Apple, very, very different. Apple is all about hardware. They're not actually the best software people in the world. Microsoft's way better with software than Apple is. Apple's way better with hardware, right? Their focus is hardware. I don't think Apple and Microsoft have always been seen as competitors. I don't think they're even in the same industry, okay? Yes, generally in the computer industry, but Dell Technologies, you wouldn't think Dell Technologies and You know, how's Dell Technologies a competitor to Microsoft? No, they actually are complementary. Well, Dell Technologies is a competitor to Apple, right? Because you've got hardware and hardware. So these people have all specialized. That's where they've made their money. Do they have multiple streams of income? Absolutely. They have multiple streams of income from the same types of assets following a single decision that they've refined over the years. Do they get better all the time? Absolutely. I mean, you look at Tesla, for example, it's not always been a great company. In fact, people might even question the company now. I don't. I think Tesla's a great company. Elon Musk, one of my heroes, because I see how specific and focused he is on what he's doing. And he's changing the world, right? He's changing the world already. He will send people to Mars, right? But it's all about the energy to get it there, right? He's very much focused on energy. Let me just tell you a little story. So another way to look at it is what I call, and by the way, I can't draw, so I'm going to write it. I call it the Blue Honda Rule. And you should probably write this down because this is actually a very important rule. And there is a scientific term for it, which I can never remember. And besides which, I like calling it the Blue Honda Rule. The story behind the Blue Honda Rule goes like this. Let's say that you go to, you're looking for a new car. And what you're looking for is dependability. You want a good deal on the car. Okay, so Blue Honda Rule, you know, makes sense that an accountant is talking about Blue Honda Rule, right? Because Honda, boy, you think accountant, you think Honda. And you decide, boy, you've done all your research. You go to the dealer and you say, tell you what, I want this Honda. And this is what I want on it, and I want it to be blue. And, you know, this model, et cetera, et cetera. And the dealer says to you, wow, that's a great car. Great decisions on that. We don't have one like that in stock. Let me check my computer. Oh, we'll have one for you in 3 weeks. So for the next 3 weeks, right, you're thinking about this blue Honda because you're pretty excited about this new car you're going to get because it's a pretty hot car. And this blue Honda is on your mind, which means that you see blue Hondas everywhere you turn. It's amazing how many blue Hondas you see. You never saw so many blue Hondas before. All of a sudden, they're coming out of the woodwork. Why is that? The reason is simply because you have become laser focused on that blue Honda. That focus is what causes you to see the blue Honda. Think about this as it applies to investing. What is the single biggest challenge for investors? Biggest challenge for investors, in my experience, is deal flow. Where are the deals coming from? How do I find those deals? Where do I get those deals? The deal flow comes from what you're looking at. See, the deals are always there. Some of you heard my story about my client who, for tax reasons, wanted to learn how to deduct his travel from Arizona to New Mexico. And I explained you have to spend 4.5 hours a day in business, doing business. More, it's got to be your primary reason for going. So he comes back and he's very excited. And I said, did you spend 4.5 hours a day? He said, absolutely. I said, did you document that? He said, absolutely. I've got it written down in a journal and who I talked to and where I went and everything. I said, great. So that should be deductible. And he says, wait. There's something bigger than the tax deduction here. I said, what's that? He says, I found a deal. I said, what? He said, oh, I found a deal. This is a land development deal that I can do. And after all is said and done, I should net right around $1 million. So I had to ask him, did that deal just happen to come up while you were there? He said, nope, it's been there for years. It's actually been there for years. I just never saw it before. See, now he was focused. The tax law, this is interesting. The tax law actually got him to focus, right? Because he had to look at real estate. So he was focusing on his business while he was in New Mexico instead of focusing on, you know, whatever else he was doing, art, etc. He had to focus. Well, he decided ahead of time, this is how I'm going to spend my time. I'm going to spend it looking for deals. Well, when he spent out looking for deals, he knew what kind of deals he was looking for. He was in the contracting business. He's going, doing a land development deal, makes all the sense in the world to him. So he had narrowed his focus, actually, as a result of wanting the tax deduction, and he found a deal. I have another friend in Scotland, and this friend of mine in Scotland, there was a church, an old, old church that was, he'd passed by 100 times, and literally thousands and thousands of people passed by it every day on their way to work, because it was on the main route, and it was just this old, old church, and nobody gave a second thought to it until he started determining what he wanted to do for investing purposes. And he decided he wanted to do condos, and he was looking for a condo deal. So he walks by this church. He goes, I wonder if we could turn this church into a condo deal. And he actually, what he discovered was that not only could he, but the government would actually pay him to do the rehab, because this was an historic structure. So he was able to find this deal. He'd seen it before, but he'd never seen it as a deal. So when we get laser focused, what happens is that the deals that were always there, we start to see. On top of that, we start talking about deals, right? We start talking about deals. We start talking about what's going on in our lives, what kind of investments. We start spending time with people who are going to have the types of deals we're looking for, because that's who we want to spend time with. So all of this, what happens is that the deals just show up. We don't have to search and search and search. We just have to be open to them by creating a very specific set of criteria. We create a very specific set of criteria. Now, your criteria are going to be different from anybody else's criteria. Let me explain what happens, though, when you have this set of criteria, because I've experienced this. So my partner and I, years ago, decide we play cash flow. We play the cash flow game, right? And we decide we want to invest in real estate because this makes sense. So let's go do it. We have good cash flow from our business. Let's go invest in real estate. So we got really focused on what we wanted to do. We sat down and developed our set of criteria. This is about 16 years ago. We developed this set of criteria. Then what we did was we went over this set of criteria with our team. But one of the things we definitely want to do with our team members is we want them to know our criteria. So first we have to know our criteria. I'm going to walk through that in just a minute. What types of things need to be in your criteria? I'm just going to give you a list of 10 things that should be in your criteria. You probably won't use all of them, and you'll probably use some that I haven't given to you, right? I just want to give you some basic ones so that you can start thinking about your criteria. So we'd let our, what I'm going to call our acquisition manager, okay? He was our realtor, right? Our acquisition manager. We'd let him know what we were looking for. And we were extraordinarily specific. How many bedrooms, how many baths, where, price, all these criteria that I'm going to go through with you. So I'm in a three-day event, a Rich Dad three-day, okay? And any of you who have been to a Rich Dad three-day know that they're pretty intense. The breaks are short. And you don't have a lot of time to do anything else. I happened to be on a break. I think it was day two. I get a call from my acquisition manager, and he calls me up. His name's Brian, and he says, "Tom, I've got a deal for you." I said, "Great." And he starts to go into the deal, et cetera. And I said, "Time out." I said, "Brian, does it meet all of our criteria?" And he says, "Yes, as a matter of fact, it does." I said, "Great. What's the price?" He tells me. I said, "When do you need the money?" And he tells me that. I said, "Great. Come by my office tomorrow. I'll have a check for you." that's how long the conversation was. So I think 3 minutes is kind of a long conversation when it comes to pulling, actually saying yes to a deal. Because if you've already done the homework and then you have a good team that does the legwork for you, so you've done your homework in setting your criteria, then what happens is your team members, they do the legwork for you. Remember, investing is a team sport. What do amateur investors do? They do it themselves. Professional investors always use a team because you can't get enough done by yourself and you're not that smart. I know I'm not that smart. So I need a team around me. I need a team around me to just do tax work. And I'm actually pretty knowledgeable about tax work. And yet I still put a team around me because I believe you do what you're best at and you have your team do what they're best at. And we'll talk about that when we talk about team in another course. Let's talk about this set of criteria because this is going to make the difference between success and failure and just how much success you have and how much time you spend. The challenge for most people is that we have full-time jobs. Investing for most people is not a full-time job. I think investing should take less than an hour a week. I do. I think it should take less than an hour a week. With the right team members, once we're set up for it. Now, until we're set up for it, it's going to take a little more time. Developing these criteria, you're going to sit down with your business partner, your spouse, your children, whoever it is that you have involved, and then you're going to sit down with your team members. And your team members may actually help you develop the criteria. Remember, when we talked about your dream, what we came up with was return on investment. Then, when we talk about, okay, how do we really drill in and develop our, massive passive income, we looked at the asset class. Now we're drilling down deeper. And now we're into the nitty-gritty. And we've already chosen our asset class, so we know it's going to be real estate, commodities, business, or paper. We know what type of business, commodities, real estate, or paper it's going to be. So that decision has already been made. Now what we're doing is we're saying, okay, let's say that we've decided on multifamily housing as an example, okay? We decide multifamily housing. Now we have to look at the specific criteria for the multifamily housing that we want to buy. And by the way, the same would be true with option trading. The same would be true with oil and gas or coal or agriculture or solar. The same would be true for any business. We're going to go through the same steps regardless. And it's, the return on investment is less a function of the investment and more a function of the investor. The return on investment, the success of investment, is less a function of the investment and more a function of the investor. I give you another example before I go on. So I have two good friends in the multifamily housing industry. One of them is all about going in and doing a value add, meaning that they would really like a rundown property. And they'd like to really, they've got all the know-how to improve that property, get tenants in it, completely rehabilitate it, and turn it into an amazing return. I have another client is looking for stable cash flow. It'd be great if he can do some improvement. They're looking for different rates of return. They have different sets of criteria. They're looking for different types of property. One, the first one would never buy a Class A property, right? Never buy a Class A property because Class A properties don't need that much improvement as a general rule. He'd only buy Class B. He doesn't want Class C. He may take a marginal Class C that he can turn into a Class B, but he's very specific. My other friend would happily take a Class B plus, A minus. He's probably not going to, he doesn't build from scratch because that's not in his criteria. He's taking used property. And they have just a very different set of criteria. And yet they're both investing in multifamily housing and they're both successful investors. So you can't say, well, I want the criteria that works best. What you can say is, I want the criteria that works best for me. What's right for you is not what's right for somebody else, and vice versa. And I just want to emphasize this, because what I hear all the time is, I mean, I heard it from a client not too long ago, terrific, terrific doctor, great client. And he said, I just want what produces the best return. I said, it doesn't work that way. They all produce the best return, and they all produce the worst return. It's all dependent on you. But now we're into the nitty-gritty. Now we're talking about the specific criteria. Now that you know what you want to do, and if you're still uncertain, stop here. Go back. Go back to massive passive income. Go back to this idea of, how do I determine what asset class I'm in? Okay? Go back to, how do I determine my asset class? Because until you determine that, you can't do criteria. There's an order to this. There's an order to this. You start with your dream, then you determine your asset class, and then you can do your criteria. So let's look at criteria. I think number one, and I think this should be universal, and I would encourage that this be your number one decision, is cash flow. Now, how much cash flow and when that cash flow comes is part of that question, right? So you can get more specific than that. It can be cash flow from each transaction. It can be cash flow from each tenant. It can be cash flow from each property. It can be cash flow from a group of properties. It can be annual cash flow. It can be monthly cash flow. It can be daily cash flow. It could be an amount, or it could be a percentage of what you invested. Cash flow, though, is everything in business and investing revolves around cash flow in the end, unless you're a speculator. And if you're a speculator, I would say you're not a professional investor. Professional investors do not speculate. That's gambling. And I don't know any professional investors who gamble, okay? They might take an educated risk. It's not a gamble, because they're not rolling the dice. They have gone through all their criteria. I mean, the reality is, even coming up with our own strategy, we have specific criteria, and there's still risk there. It's just that we've narrowed the risk, because what we know is, if the investment meets these criteria, and we do our due diligence to make sure that that investment meets those criteria, then we're safe, right? If we have enough cash flow, think about this. Those people who had real estate in 2006, 2007, that had good cash flow from that real estate, when the market went down, did that change their cash flow? Probably did. The cash flow actually went down when the real estate went down, because people started doubling up and tripling up on housing. So you had a whole multi-generations. If your cash flow was sufficient, though, you could weather it. If your cash flow wasn't sufficient, you were going to lose the property. You're going to just be pouring tons of money from other sources into that investment property. Those who had the cash flow already, though, weathered that storm just fine. And then what they had was, they had more cash flow to buy at bargain prices in 2010 and 11. Those who had to put money into their projects because they didn't have the good cash flow, I was one of those, okay? I've learned the hard way on this. I had to fund so much cash flow into those properties, I did not have cash flow to buy other properties. So not only did I lose out by having to fund these properties, but I lost out because I couldn't buy other properties. There's your challenge. That's why cash flow, I think, is number one. The rest of these, I'm not going to tell you, have any particular order to them and any particular hierarchy to them. I'm just suggesting that these are additional criteria that you might want to include. Now, number two I would put in here is return on investment. And I'm going to write this out, because if I just write ROI, some of you will say, what's ROI? Sorry, and it's not return of. Let me be very clear here. It is return on investment. And return on investment actually has two different aspects to it. It has an aspect of current cash flow, and it does have an aspect of gain or increase in value. So I talked about my buddy who does value-added multifamily. That increase in value is very important to him because what he wants to be able to do is increase the value enough that he can borrow, he can raise, that raises the valuation, and I'll get back to that in a second, but that raises the valuation so much that he can go back to the bank and take his money out and all the money for the investors, and so basically they have no money into it. Creates what Robert Kiyosaki would call an infinite return. Okay, so that increase in value for him, now he's current cash flow is important to him. Potential cash flow. So current cash flow, and I'm going to add in here future cash flow. So both of those are part of that return on investment, and then increase in value for him, which comes from additional cash flow, right? That's how you increase the value, is to increase your cash flow and improve the cap rate on the property. So this is actually the next aspect of this, and it's closely related to return on investment, and that is cap rate. Now, I'm using cap rate. That is a terminology, that's a term used in real estate, capitalization rate. In paper assets, it would be called PE ratio. And in business, it would be called a multiple. They are all the same thing. They're all related to the cash flow from the investment. Now, a cap rate is calculated as the net operating income divided by the value. So when you buy it, it's going to be net operating income divided by the purchase price. Well, cap rate is a function. These are all a function of cash flow and risk. They're a function of cash flow and risk, and it's really the risk of the cash flow. It's the risk of the cash flow. So cap rate, if you look at an asset and you go, what's my likelihood of getting that cash flow? And if I'm in a Class C property, I'm probably going to have a lot of turnover. I'm going to have repairs, you know, because it's run down, maybe in a tough part of town. That's Class C property. So my risk is going to be high. So I'm going to expect a higher cap rate to compensate me for that risk. Now, if I can turn that Class C property into a Class B property, now my risk is going down. So while my cash flow is going up, at the same time, my cash flow is going up, my cap rate is also going up. Let me show you an example. Okay, so we have cash flow, return on investment, and then what I call, I'm just going to call cap rate. Okay, let me give you an example of cap rate. I think this is the most important term in real estate, and I know a lot of you are real estate investors. Again, PE ratio, business multiple, same thing. Okay, same thing. So, cap rate, let's say that I have $10,000 of net operating income, right? This is my NOI. And to get that NOI, I paid $100,000. So that means my cap rate is 10%. Now, that's a pretty high cap rate. All right, even in a tough economy. In a good economy, that's unheard of. But in a tough economy, that's still a decent cap rate. That means decent, meaning that there's some risk in there. Okay, there's some risk in the tenant, there's some risk in the area, there's some risk in the building, there's some kind of risk built into that 10% because you compare that to a risk-free rate, which would be like a treasury bond, right? That's the closest comparison we have to a risk-free rate. And if you have a 10% cap rate, your risk-free rate is probably somewhere in the, you know, 3 to 5% range. So you're talking about a premium for the risk. It's called a risk premium. Actually, that's what it's actually called, is a risk premium. Let's say that this is a Class C property. And now I do some things to the property, all right? And now my net operating income goes from $10,000 to $12,000, right? And my cap rate, okay, my cap rate, now let's say my cap rate stayed the same. If I had a cap rate of 10%, remember I'm just moving things around here, then my value would be $120,000, right? That would be $120,000. But what if I've reduced the risk? Now I don't have to add such a high risk premium to my cap rate, right? So you can think of a cap rate as, if you paid cash for this property, what would be your return? What would be your ROI if you paid cash for the property? And that's where the 10% comes from, okay, in this case. Now let's say that I actually reduce my risk and I have $12,000. I still have the $12,000, right? But I reduce my risk to, let's see if I can do one that I can do the math on. 8%, okay? Now I've got $12,000 divided by 8%, right? So that means that I think if I've got this right, it's now my value is $150,000. I think I did that right. So at $150,000, it's worth more than the $120,000, not because my cash flow went up, my cash flow stayed the same, but because I reduced the risk for the buyer. So that the risk of getting that cash flow has gone down, so the risk premium goes down, and now my cap rate goes down as well, right? Again, somebody is willing to spend, buy this property and be happy with an 8% return. Now, sometimes the market just dictates this. I mean, we've seen this. I mean, if you go from 2010 to 2018, for example, I mean, you had cap rates drop precipitously. They dropped literally in half or more. And nothing to do with the person that was improving the property, right? They just went down because the market, you know, because of the market, because there was so much money, it was just that was a supply and demand when it came to money, right, in investing. So cap rate can also be impacted by market factors. What I'm looking for here is I want to look at the cap rate, and I'm going to look for two things. One is, in my criteria, what is the current cap rate, and what is my potential cap rate? So just like I looked for return on investment, what's my current cash flow, what's my potential cash flow, I'm looking at what's my current cash rate, cap rate, and what's my potential cap rate. In other words, am I taking a C property and all I'm doing is filling it up with tenants? I am not changing the risk premium there. I just have more tenants. So my net operating income is going up. My cap rate is staying the same. If I convert that property from a Class C property, which is a high risk property, to a Class B property, which is a middle risk class, then what I've done is I've reduced the risk as well. So my potential cap rate is lower than my current cap rate. Or I could take a Class B property, turn Class A property. Same thing. I'm just lowering the risk. I could take a business and do the same thing. The reason that PE ratios are higher than business multiples. So let's talk about that for a second. So if you're looking at a PE ratio, so a PE ratio is price to earnings ratio. Now, I'm going to compare that to a multiple, a business multiple. Now, when you'd have a business multiple is simply your cash flow This is cash flow times a number. Okay. And what we're talking about is I'm selling my business to another single business owner, okay, or to a company that is just going to operate it for what it is. So that multiple typically is going to be normally 3 to 5. Sometimes it'll be as high as 8. The PE ratio multiple is frequently 20 to 25 times multiple, right? Frequently 20 to 25 times. Why the difference? This same company that had a 5 multiple could now have a 25 multiple. What's the difference? Well, the difference is, and you should might figure this out by now, it's risk. Because here we're talking about a public company, and here we're talking about a private company. And a public company, what can I do? With a public company, I have something that I don't have with a private company. I have liquidity. So sometimes people call it a liquidity premium, right? Because I have liquidity, I can buy and sell immediately. So what does that do? That reduces my risk because I can sell it at any time. Whereas a private company, can I sell that at any time? I might be able to sell it, but in a down economy, think about this. Things come down. We have a huge crash like we did in 2008-9. Could you still sell IBM stock or Amazon stock or Apple stock? Of course you could. Now you take a severe discount on it, but you could still get out. A small business, could you sell that? You may not have been able to sell that at all because there wasn't any money in the market to buy it. So the liquidity risk of a private business is the highest. If you look at a 5 multiple, that would equal a cap rate. That equals a 20% cap rate, right? Because I'm paying 5 times the cash flow. So that means that if my cash flow is $10,000, my value is $50,000, which gives me a 20% cap rate. That's a fairly typical cap rate for a closely held business, a private business. You can see that that is much higher than you're going to get in real estate. Why is that? Because a business is intangible. A business is intangible and it's not liquid. Real estate is tangible and not liquid. Stocks are extraordinarily liquid, and that's why there's such a high premium PE ratio. That's why you get such a high premium with stocks. And of course, the stronger the company, the higher the PE ratio. It's because the risk is perceived as much lower. Are they going to produce that income year after year after year? Is it Walgreens? Is it Amazon? Is it Apple? Are they going to continue to produce that income year after year after year? All right, I'm confident. They've been doing this. They're going to keep doing it. All right? You see a company like Tesla goes up and down, up and down, up and down. The track record's not there yet. It's not there yet. So you might have a high PE ratio in a Tesla just because there's not a lot of E, right? Your earnings might be low. And you just go, I'm projecting out what I think it will be. That's what you're doing. And a PE ratio typically looks at not just today, but it looks at tomorrow. A cap rate, for the most part, looks at today. A multiple, earnings multiple, looks at today. But sometimes it'll look at tomorrow. The reason that you sometimes get up to 8 multiple is because you've got somebody that goes, well, for you, who's operating it now, it's only worth 5 times. For me, I can do this, this, and this with it. See, the question is, what's it worth to you? And in a private company, it's going to be worth different to different people. Now, I know we're talking about criteria. I want you to understand these criteria, because especially cap rate, because I believe cap rate is one of the most important criteria, or multiple or PE ratio, whatever that is for you. But it's a relationship of the value to the cash flow. That's what it is. It's a relationship of the value to the cash flow. There's always included a liquidity risk. Always a liquidity risk part of it, or liquidity premium, right? And there's, in addition to liquidity, there's just this overall risk premium. So there's a liquidity premium and there's a risk premium. And they're related, right? Because they're all about risk. Get in, get out. That's why your PE ratio, which, by the way, 25 times PE ratio is effectively what? A 4% cap rate, right? You just invert it. So a 25 times PE ratio is equivalent, because all you do is flip these over, right? So if you have 25 to 1, right? This is value to cash flow. That's earnings, right? You flip it over, it's 1 over 25 equals 4%. I'm just trying to help you get a handle on cap rate, on just this whole idea of, you know, price, cash flow to valuation. My rich dad advisor buddies and I were in Rome a few years ago, and this doctor was heckling us. These were students. They paid like $5,000 to be there, and he's heckling us. Well, we know all that. So my buddy gets up there. He's in the real estate business. He gets up there and he says, this was Ken McElroy. Some of you know him. So he gets up there and in fact, he turned to the rest of it. He says, watch this. He gets up there and he says, how many of you understand cap rate? Who could explain cap rate to me? Out of 100 people, not one hand went up. This is the most fundamental computation of all real estate, is cap rate. So you must understand this. And you can see, you have to understand in business, which would include, by the way, that's how you're going to value an oil well, right? Because it's a business, or a farm, or a ranch, or a timber, right? It's all going to be valued the same way. So you want to know, if you're going to come with your return on investment, and part of your return on investment is your gain, your gain's going to be a function of, unless you're a speculator, right? It's going to be a function of cash flow and risk. It's that simple. All right, so we've just gone through three so far. We've gone through cash flow, return on investment, and cap rate. Here's another one. So we're going to go back to criteria. And I'm going to add some more for you. And then I'll list them all at the end so you have a complete list. Another criteria that I would have would be my arbitrage rate. Now, arbitrage is simply, let me see if I can explain this the right way. It's cap rate minus cost of money, cost of funds rate. So to give you an example of this, let's say that my cash on cash return, which is my cap rate, my cash on cash return, when I buy it, that's my cash on cash return. Let's say my cash on cash return is 10%. And let's say my borrowing rate is 6%. That would mean that my arbitrage rate would be 4%. Now, of course, this only matters if you're going to use debt in your investing, right? I mean, if you're using, if you're investing in the stock market and you're not using leverage, whether it be leveraged through options. Options, by the way, are one way to leverage in the stock market, my favorite way. You can also leverage through a margin account, right? If you leverage through a margin account, please understand, learn options, because you need to protect yourself on that margin. So you can leverage in paper. You can leverage in business. We all know we borrow all the time in business, and obviously we can leverage in real estate. That's your arbitrage rate. Another one, so actually this is 1, 2, 3, this is number 4, so let's make sure we got these, that's number 4, and this is actually number 5, so I'm actually going to, turns out I'm going to give you more than 10, okay. Next one is I would look at your market. Now, your market includes actually several aspects. In real estate, it would include your location. Okay. In stocks, it depends on what you're doing in paper assets, but it could include your industry. Right? in business, it's going to include your customers. But determining your market is critical because you don't want to be scattered. Again, we're trying to focus here. We're trying to get so specific that we have very, if we're putting marketing dollars, you don't want to spray marketing dollars all over the place. That's such a waste of money. We need to know our market. We need to determine our market. And then we can be very specific and targeted about where we spend our marketing dollars if we're in business, for example. Okay, or we can be very specific in where we buy our real estate, or we can be very specific on what industry we're investing in the stock market. So the market, or we just look at the market as a whole. Okay, are we large cap, small cap, mid cap? Okay, international, Asian, you know, Pan American. I mean, these are all markets in paper assets. So every type of investing has a market. So you want to get really specific in your market. Next, customers. So I've got customers up here in market. I think you have to go even deeper into your customers. So who are your customers? If you're looking at real estate and you're in residential, for example, who is going to rent? Who are these people? Are they W-2 employees? Are they business owners? Are they doctors? Are they healthcare professionals? Are they military? Who are they? If you are in business, who are your customers going to be? If you're in the stock market, customers can sometimes be less important, okay? So you may not use that criteria if you're in paper assets at all, because you may not even be focused on customers. All right, let's look at the next one. So this is still criteria here, right? I'm just giving you a few ideas for what your criteria might be. So we're on number 7 here. Now, this is one that definitely doesn't happen in paper assets. And this is brand promise. However, when it comes to particularly, now brand promise probably does not, may not enter into things in commodities. You say, well, oil is oil. Well, it's not quite, okay? There are different grades of oil. So in that brand promise, I would be determining what kind of oil and what quality of oil am I going to deliver. If I'm in business, now that's pretty obvious. My brand promise is, what am I telling customers that they should expect from me? If I'm in real estate, the same thing. What am I telling tenants that they should expect if they rent from one of my properties? And it doesn't matter if it's commercial, residential, industrial. There's a brand promise there. We have a strip center. I call him the king of strip centers in Arizona, in the Phoenix area in Arizona. And he's very clear on his brand promise. His strip centers are very clean. They're tidy. They're always rented, always rented. And they don't all look exactly the same. So that the brand promise doesn't necessarily go to the look from a specific look, because I've seen different versions, but I'm always looking at strip centers because I'm fascinated. That's one of the areas in real estate that I'm actually fascinated by, strip centers. He has the same types of tenants. You know, his anchor tenants are going to be similar. You know, he's looking for the same type of pads. These are the restaurant pads, etc. Very much a brand. He's built a brand of strip centers. You go, wow, how do you build a brand of strip? So this is still criteria here, right? I'm just giving you a few ideas for what your criteria might be. So we're on number 7 here, centers. There's a company that does storage units. I know two big companies do storage units. They have developed brands, and they're very different brands. They're very different brands. So what's your promise to your customers? Whether you're in real estate or business, or even I think in commodities, because, you know, look at, let's say that you grow oranges. All right. So what type of oranges do you grow? Do you grow navel oranges? Do you grow Valencia oranges? What color is the juice? What flavor is the juice? Are they juice oranges? Are they oranges that you're going to peel and eat? Those are brand promises. So I think that outside of paper, I think that brand promise is a pretty big deal. And I think that I suggest that you develop it early on. Number 8, leverage. Now, this is different than arbitrage, because arbitrage is just the difference between what you bring in and what you pay for the debt. That's all arbitrage is, that difference between the two. Now, in paper, you're going to have arbitrage is a big deal, right? It's a very big deal. There are lots of people that they make their entire living on arbitrage. So arbitrage, big deal there. Leverage is different. Leverage is how much of somebody else's money am I going to use, or how much of somebody else's time and effort am I going to use? So I have leverage both from a financial leverage standpoint. I have financial leverage, and I have people leverage. And I want to decide what kind of leverage am I going to use and my criteria. So when I'm looking at business, for example, so I'll take mine just to be a little different than real estate. Leverage is pretty obvious in real estate, I think. When, in real estate, you're going, am I going 75% loan to value, 80% loan to value, 70% loan to value, 50% loan to value? What do I want my leverage to be? There's a risk factor in there, isn't there? And there's a reward factor in there. Because, of course, the higher your leverage, the higher your reward, the higher your leverage, the more your risk. So you've got to decide, right? It's not right and wrong. It's not good and bad. It's what you want in your situation. We have leverage. Now, the next thing we have to look at is, of course, my favorite, which is taxes. How does this, what do I want from a tax consequence? Some people don't care. They honestly don't care. I have clients, you would expect I would have clients, that's high on their mind. I've literally heard Robert Kiyosaki say, I buy real estate because it reduces my taxes. So clearly that's a big part of real estate for Robert. I have other people go, they're very objective about it. Okay, it depends, right? I would like the overall return, and I have this much capacity for tax benefits. Your tax benefits can be so big that you can't use them all. So then you have to look at, can I have somebody else, like my investors, can they get the tax benefits? And if they get the tax benefits, can they use the tax benefits? Right? Because there are restrictions on how you use tax benefits. And if they can't use the tax benefits, can I help them to use those tax benefits, or do they have to sit down with a tax advisor to determine how to use those tax benefits? So I'm just saying, taxes are a major part of your return. Your tax benefits, particularly in real estate, oil and gas, can be as large or larger than your cash flow benefits. That's how important taxes are. So do not ignore taxes. Here's another one. I think this is critical. Exit. Right? We talked about liquidity risk in business and in real estate. We have liquidity risk. We have a liquidity premium in paper assets because they're so easy to get in and out of, or certain paper assets, right? So there can be a liquidity premium. How are you going to exit? At what point are you going to exit? Is there a particular cap rate at which you exit? Is there a particular interest rate of the bank at which you exit? If you think about it, if your cap rate goes down below your borrowing rate, that's a negative arbitrage. That's not a good place. You might really want to consider selling at that point. If your cap rate actually goes below your arbitrage rate, below your cost of capital rate, then you have a negative arbitrage, and that's not a good place to be. So that might be one of your indications of when to sell. So at what point do I sell this? I've heard people say, well, I never sell a property. You're nuts. You're nuts to say that. I never sell a property. You may say, my strategy is buy and hold. Let's say you're real estate, okay? And you say, my primary strategy is buy and hold. there may come a time where you go, it just makes no sense for me to hold it anymore. And you sell. You may not sell all your properties, but you may determine, look, I'm going to sell these properties because it no longer makes sense for me to hold them. I have stupid money begging to buy my properties. Stupid, you know, what we call stupid money, right? Which is crazy money. It's just so much money that you just can't even conceive of why would you ever, because you would never spend the money on that. One way I look at exit is, would I buy this property net of, okay, for the cost, net of the transaction cost? Because, of course, anytime you sell, you've got commission expense, you've got costs of selling the property, plus you've got time. So I always look at, would I buy this property at the price that I'm going to net out of it? Would I buy this property at the price I'm going to net out of it? If not, maybe you want to consider selling it, because maybe then there's another property you could buy, because you've got an opportunity cost of holding on to that. So determining your exit is critical. And I would determine it up front. What's my exit? Because then how much easier is that decision? If you determined your exit, okay, if we hit this, I'm exiting. Now, does that mean you have to exit at that time? No. What it means is it's a trigger, so that now you are considering, oh, I need to think about exiting. I mean, not exit, but I need to think about exiting. So it's a trigger for you. Another one. I'm going to give you two more. One is insurance. How am I going to insure this investment? So you're talking about real estate. It's pretty easy. I need fire insurance. I need flood insurance. That's my insurance. I may want some type of a market insurance. So I might want insurance against drastic changes in the market. That's another type of insurance. In the stock market, I absolutely want insurance. I can do that through stop loss, putting stop losses on it. I can do it through options. There's a number of ways to create insurance for paper assets. Commodities rely heavily on insurance. My heavens, my cotton farmer client, insurance was a huge part of his business, because he would have times where his only revenue was from the insurance. So the insurance was in agriculture, especially, can be huge. And then, of course, in business, you absolutely need insurance. You need insurance against lawsuits. You need insurance for, you know, a number of things, but lawsuits are kind of the big one, because you can get sued by an employee, you can get sued by a customer, you can get sued by a stranger. I mean, so like, for example, I mean, you're going to carry, you think of a doctor, you know, they call you malpractice insurance, an accountant carries errors and omissions insurance, and there's all sorts of other insurances. So insurance is actually a major part of criteria, what type of insurance am I going to need. And then the last one, last but not least, which is probably one that you're going, why is this last? It's just because that's the order I wrote them down on. And that is actually your investment amount. And you notice I did not say price, because price includes leverage. Right, but if I take my leverage and I add in my investment amount, I'm going to have my price. So I just broke it down between, I just broke leverage and investment down together, because they really go together. My leverage and my investment amount, you know, how much I'm actually putting in the deal, right? And I'm talking about dollars here. I'm not talking about time, okay? Though you should consider how much time are you willing and want to spend on this investment. That is a major consideration. So I would actually, you know what, I'm going to add that in there. I think investment amount and time is part of that. So there you go. You've got 12 different criteria, and let me just write them out for you. You have them all together. Okay, here's my criteria. And there are other criteria. You may look at this and you go, you know what, there's like 5 things on here I don't care anything about. And there's a bunch of stuff that I do care about. That's fine. This is not an exhaustive list. Determine your criteria. I just wanted to give you an idea. So cash flow. Number one, I'm just a big believer. I just suffered too much from not making that one. Okay, ROI, cap rate, arbitrage, right? Arbitrage. Okay, market. Customers, number seven is brand promise. And see, obviously, some of these, like brand promise, aren't going to apply to paper. And some of the paper ones may not apply to some of the others. So take what is what you believe or what's important to you. Leverage. Number nine, taxes. Please do not forget that one. No matter who you are, I think that if you ignore taxes, I think it's at your peril. Taxes are a major, have such a major impact on your overall returns. Exit, insurance, and last but not least, investment amount and time. So once we have those criteria, now we've really got an idea, a really clear idea of what we're going to do. Now it's a matter of sitting down with our team, sitting down our team, going through our criteria, making sure they understand them, and getting them to buy off on it and say, you know what, these are not their criteria, these are your criteria. So you expect them to follow your criteria precisely. Now you may rank them, you may say, look, these six criteria, absolutely essential. These other four, let's say you have 10 of them, these other four, they'd be nice. They're not essential. Make sure that you follow those criteria once you set them. Please, at least when you start out, don't deviate. You may need to adjust those criteria and you will fine-tune those criteria as you go. Remember, you may even at some point completely change asset classes or at least change type of asset within that class. Very common. You start out doing single family homes, and you go, you know what? I've gotten my feet wet. I've started small. I want to do multifamily or I want to do commercial. Makes total sense, right? It makes total sense. While you're doing it though, stick with your criteria, except for maybe those little tweaks as you go. You may go, well, that's kind of an aggressive criteria. You know, I wanted 20% cash on cash return, and there's just not, it's just really, really too hard to find right now. I'm okay with 15%, or I'm okay with 10%, whatever it is, right? So it's okay to modify, but tweak it. Small adjustments, right? Small adjustments. And be slow about adjusting your criteria because I think your criteria is what's going to make you a lot of money while you pay a lot less taxes. Thanks very much. See you next time.